Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy. I'm Chris North, and what you're about to listen to was originally broadcast as part of Pythagoras' Trousers, a science and engineering show on Radio Cardiff. You can find a full show and listen to past episodes at pythagorastrousers.co.uk. But for now, here's this month's astronomy. Well, what an exciting year it's been for space exploration, both robotic missions and, of course, human spaceflight. More on that later. To talk about what's been going on this past year and what we can look forward to in 2016, I'm joined again by Edward Gomez. Welcome back.
Hello.
So, it's been a really cool year for missions around the solar system. We should probably start off with Rosetta, which has been there for over a year now, orbiting this comet, but we got a lot of results out of it this year.
Yeah, that's right. Remember, Rosetta's actually not a new mission. It's been in the solar system for over 10 years now, but it had its closest approach to the comet 67P, Kirimirov-Gerasimenko back in October 2014. It's been trying to gather data from orbit around the comet, and also it sent this little lander Philae onto the surface of the comet last year. But we're still reaping all the benefits from that.
We had the closest approach of the comet to the sun, its perihelion, back in August of this year. And some of the images, they got down to resolutions of, you know, a meter or so. It was really amazing resolution.
Yeah, truly tremendous, much better than Google Maps.
Yeah. And the things we're seeing now, as the comet heads further from the sun, Rosetta's now got an extension to its mission. It's going to track it until about September 2016.
Yeah, that's right. And at that point, their current thinking is that they will smash Rosetta, the orbiting part of the mission, the satellite bit, into the comet. They could just carry on having it orbit, but as it heads further out into the outer solar system, it's going to become hard and increasingly harder to track it and get data back from it. So they're thinking that it'll go out in a blaze of glory and make a big hole in the comet, and we'll learn quite a lot from that. It seems like quite a weird thing to do, but the Deep Impact mission in about 2004-2005 did something very similar to that, and we learned a lot about the internal composition of a comet.
It's also because as it spirals inwards, we'll get higher and higher and higher resolution views of bits of the comet, which will be great. And we might, of course, even hear back from Philae, although it's been a bit silent the last few months.
Yeah, that's right.
Further out in the solar system, another mission that's been going on for about 10 years as well is, of course, New Horizons, which whizzed past Pluto at some incredible tens of thousands of miles an hour back in July this year. And the images from that have been astounding as well.
Yeah, so I think it's currently going at about 58,000 miles an hour. And it is the fastest human-made object ever.
Yeah, it was the fastest on launch, certainly. It's had a speed up from Jupiter and so on. So it's never coming back.
No, that's right. That thing is gone. But it's seen Pluto in quite fantastic detail, and the surface of Pluto is stranger than we thought it was. It's it has that wonderful heart-shaped region on the surface, which appears to be quite smooth, and then darker regions around it, as if the surface has been uncovered by something. We're not entirely sure what.
And the interpretation of the light heart-shaped region, this bright white region, is that that's actually glaciers of nitrogen that are edging over the surface, much like we get glaciers in Greenland here, for example, which is something we never expected to see.
No, exactly. That's one of the reasons for doing this. You're constantly surprised.
And the features that we see on Pluto and its large moon, Charon, however you want to pronounce it, the features we see tell us that there's something happened relatively recently, or imply that things have happened relatively recently, geologically, if you like, in those two moons, which we thought they were leftover remnants of the solar system.
Yeah, that's right. But it just shows that even things which appear to be, you know, dead still have some activity and are really scientifically interesting. Pluto's had a checkered past, of course, because it was demoted from being a planet to a dwarf planet. And so a lot of people have quite a lot of sympathy, particularly people in the US have a lot of sympathy for Pluto. The reason in the US is because it was an American person who named the planet when it was discovered.
And the results from New Horizons, much like Rosetta, are going to keep on coming back. We're still waiting for some of the data. It's trickling back at this incredibly slow rate from the spacecraft, which is 3 billion miles away. So it's a very, very slow connection. But we're looking at another 9 or 10 months of data coming back. And it's got another target to go to.
Yeah.
It's going out to another Kuiper Belt object out in the edge, even further out, a much smaller one.
Yeah, that's right. And that's so that's one of the reasons that Pluto was demoted, was that it appears to be one of these strange objects called Kuiper Belt objects. So we have in the solar system two regions where we have small bodies. We have the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, where you get a lot of just asteroids, and the Kuiper Belt, where you have frozen worlds, so sort of worlds like Pluto and Charon and maybe comets and other large asteroid type things.
And in the asteroid belt itself, of course, we've got the Dawn mission orbiting Ceres, the largest object in the asteroid belt, another dwarf planet, which was reclassified as that in 2006 along with Pluto. And Dawn is sending back images of bright white spots, which are probably salt deposits on the surface, and all sorts of interesting things that, again, are going to keep on coming for the next year.
Yeah, Ceres itself is about the same size as Pluto. It's a large thing, which is why Pluto got demoted in the end. And so similarities between Pluto and Ceres would be very interesting to see.
And talking of classifying planets, of course, we have other planets, or lots of planets now discovered outside our solar system. It's a perennial story now for the most Earth-like planet discovered, but yeah, there was another notch on that ladder this year.
Yeah, that's right, with Kepler-452b. Now, this one's quite interesting because it's a planet that's orbiting a star that's very like the Sun. And that was a first. The star in question looks very much like the Sun. It's sort of a yellowish colour, but it's significantly older than the Sun. It's still in sort of the same phase of its existence, but it's moving towards middle old age. It's in its dotage, really. It's several billion years older than our Sun. And the planet in question is orbiting at about the same distance that Earth is, but it's slightly larger as well. So it's not an exact analogue of our solar system, or where Earth is in our solar system.
And one of the things we don't know about these planets is we know often their size from the way Kepler does its measurements. We don't necessarily always know their mass, and that means we don't know their density. We don't even necessarily know whether these are rocky planets or whether they're more gaseous or got a very liquid surface.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this one, because it's relatively small in comparison to other planets, it's most likely to be a rocky one. The gaseous planets, like in our solar system, Jupiter and Saturn, they tend to be significantly larger. So we sort of think that it's probably a rocky planet, but as you said, yeah, until we get more data and more measurements of this, we don't know what its mass is, and we certainly don't know if it's got even an atmosphere on it.
And even if it has an atmosphere, what the atmosphere is like. The atmospheres of Earth and Venus, all the planets are the same kind of size, are very, very, very different,
yeah.
And that's just in our solar system. So the amount of cloud cover could make a big difference to the conditions on the surface.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of people have talked about habitability, whether this could be Earth too, but really, with so many unknowns, it's impossible to say that. I mean, one of the things that we could need to form life is we could need a big moon like the Earth has to produce tides, which eventually gets things that are living in water to crawl out onto the surface.
Who knows, lots of things to look for. Maybe over the next, maybe not the next year, the next few years, we'll start to characterise these planets further. Let's leap to something much more conceptual. We had the launch of a mission at the start of December called LISA Pathfinder, which is a technology demonstrator for a much more complex mission due for launch in the 2030s, so a little way off yet, only 20 years to wait. That's going to be called LISA. This is the Pathfinder mission. Tell us what's LISA doing?
Yeah, so LISA stands for Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, which is a very boring name. But it is looking for ripples in the fabric of the universe, which are produced when very massive things collide, or actually when very massive things spiral together. So when I say very massive things, I mean things like two black holes orbiting each other, or two neutron stars orbiting each other. And it's looking for these ripples in the fabric of space that are called gravitational waves. It's a technology driver. So this is just a single spacecraft to make sure that they can actually measure its position accurately, that they can maintain its orbit accurately, and they'll do certain maneuvers with it. Eventually, the full LISA mission will be three of these spacecraft floating in space, and they'll form sort of an equilateral triangle. and each one has two lasers on board that will fire towards two other spacecraft. And they have to maintain their distance apart very, very accurately, because the way that they did find these gravitational waves, these ripples in space-time, is by measuring any differences in the distance between the spacecraft. Something very, very difficult to do, particularly out in space.
And the Royal Course mission's on the ground already doing this. It's a lot easier to do from space, although you look at different things. It's something we spoke about last month on the show with the researchers here in Cardiff. And who knows when we'll get a discovery, or if we'll get a discovery in the next few years. It's been a few years around the corner for a while now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I remember back 15 years ago, it was only going to be 15 years away. And now we're talking about it being another 15 years in the future. Mm. So I think it's because it's such a simple idea, but it's such a difficult thing to actually achieve with the technology we have.
And then away from these missions that are going out to explore or to measure things out in the solar system and the wider cosmos, we've got the human spaceflight mission. So yeah, astronauts going up to the space station. We now, for the first time, have our own state-sponsored British astronaut in Tim Peake, who, as we record this, launched just yesterday. Very exciting time.
Yeah, very exciting. I mean, listeners will probably remember Helen Sharman, who was a Briton in space, but she was actually a cosmonaut. So she isn't really counted, and the UK didn't have a space agency then. So although she was definitely a British person in space. So Tim Peake's gone to the International Space Station. He's going to be doing some interesting stuff. He's going to be remote controlling a Mars rover. But the Mars rover isn't on Mars. It's going to be a prototype that's on Earth, to simulate what it would be like for somebody in orbit around Mars controlling a rover on the surface of Mars, which is sort of quite cool. He's doing a lot of physiological experiments to see why astronauts suffer from certain physiological problems. He's looking at making new metals, growing new metals, which is sort of exciting, doing a sort of smelting job in very, very small gravity could be interesting. But one of the weirdest things is he'll actually be growing blood vessels, which is, they're not going to be growing on himself. He's going to be growing blood vessels to see how that works in space.
Right. Exciting sort of medical research and lots of applications down here on Earth, of course, and the inspirational effect on the all sorts of people down here for thinking that space is cool and fun. And so
yeah, that's right. And he seems a really nice guy as well, so which he's very good on TV.
Now, there were lots of celebrations for the launch. We had one here in Wales at the Welsh Assembly on the launch on the 15th of December. I was lucky enough to go along and speak to a few people there. I started off by speaking to Chris Castelli from the UK Space Agency.
It's been tremendously exciting to see Tim finally, after all those years of preparation, launch from Baikonur on the Soyuz on his way to the International Space Station. So it's tremendously exciting.
And the launch here, we were sitting in the Welsh Assembly downstairs in the Senedd, and we had 150 school kids there, yeah. And they were clearly excited about this as well.
They were. I mean, that was great, just to see the effect that this has had on them, and also the live link to what was going on in the Science Museum in London, to see all the kids cheering and waving the Union Jack flags. It was really, really great. And you know, this is what we're hoping from Tim's mission, that you know, apart from the exceptional science that he's going to be doing on the ISS, we really wanted to make Tim an ambassador for science and technology, and really inspire the next generation of kids to get involved in not just space science, but science and technology subjects generally. And this is why, of course, we've planned this, you know, this really ambitious education outreach program sitting behind Tim's mission to the ISS.
And it's not all about that. He is doing science experiments up there. What kind of things is he getting up to?
Yes, I mean, it's really fascinating. The ISS is really a unique interdisciplinary research centre in space. He'll be doing a variety of projects. He'll be involved in over 30 experiments while he's on there for 6 months, covering everything from fundamental science to health sciences, biomedicine, engineering. Just to give you an idea of the flavour of some of the experiments I was just learning about, one is about a non-invasive way of measuring brain pressure. Now, we know that out in space, particularly on long-duration flights, it takes its toll on astronauts. One thing that many astronauts experience when they come back to Earth is that they suffer temporary reduction in eyesight. Right. And we believe this is linked to brain pressure, but it's very hard to measure. Scientists in the UK have developed a non-invasive technique where you put a probe into your ear and it can measure the brain pressure. So they're obviously going to experiment on Tim while he's in the space station to look at the effects of this. But that would have very real applications on the ground, where timely diagnostic of knowing brain pressure could have a really important outcome for emergency situations. So it's all of this medical research that's going on while on the space station is really finding routes down here on the ground. It's making an impact on the Earth.
And there's a lot of fundamental physics done up there relating to the fact that it's zero gravity as well. So there's things you can do in zero gravity that you can't do here on the Earth. It's hard to get away from gravity down here on the Earth.
That's absolutely right. Gravity pervades everything we do here on Earth. And as Pedro Duque was saying, you know, you've got to learn how to exist without gravity. Being able to remove gravity from science experiments helps you uncover a lot of physical processes. You can develop new materials and new alloys which don't suffer the sort of effects of gravity and the imperfections that gravity can cause. So there's a whole range of experiments in developing new materials, new semiconductor electronics that you can't do here on the ground.
And so in years to come, these will hopefully lead to new
absolutely, yes. So they'll find their way to new technologies here on Earth.
Yeah. And in terms of the outreach and engagement that he's going to be doing with school children, what kind of things has he got planned? Is he going to be doing Skype interviews with school kids? Is that the idea?
I believe he is. He's going to be able to reach out to schools and have question and answer sessions with schools. He's taking experiments on board the International Space Station. You may have heard of the AstroPi microcomputers. There are two up on the International Space Station, which are populated with sensors, and competitions are being run for schools to come up with ideas for measurements to take and then to write the code, and Tim will be running those experiments on the ISS. Yeah. So there's a whole range of activities, and you can hear all about that and what he'll be doing just going to the principia.org.uk website if you want to know more.
Excellent. So lots going on. Well, Chris Caselli, it's going to be a very exciting 6 months.
Yes.
As we record this, he's just on his way there. He hasn't yet docked, of course.
Correct.
So there's a long way to go, but it should be fun.
It should be fun, yes. Really looking forward to it.
Later on, there was an evening event at TechniQuest down in Cardiff Bay. And with all the people there, it was rather noisy. But I did get an opportunity to grab a minute with Pedro Duque, an ESA astronaut who went up to the space station about 10 years ago.
Well, I'm delighted to have come and found some chairs and be sat down with Pedro Duque, who's an astronaut from Spain, but with the European Space Agency, who's been up into space twice now. So when have you been up into space before, Pedro?
First in 1998 and 2003.
Space shuttle and then up to the space station.
Yes, two completely different missions. Yes, that's true.
How different are they, those two missions?
Well, very, very different in the way to get to space, but eventually, well, it all boils down to doing a lot of experiments in microgravity inside the laboratory. Well, the space station obviously is much more spacious, and you can do much more in there. But okay, that's advancements that happen, and one was 5 years after the other, obviously.
Sure. And the way you got up to space for the space station mission in 2003, it took you a couple of days to actually get to the space station itself. Mm-hmm. The mission that's just launched with Tim Peake on board, of course, has taken just a mere 6 hours to get there. What's led to being able to speed this up?
This is just changes in technology. So in principle, what we were doing is 48 hours in order to allow time for the ground stations to actually very accurately pinpoint where we were and send us commands to make orbital corrections little by little. Now they have got better antennas, and they know they have got GPS receivers and everything, so it is easier to know where a spacecraft exactly is. So we can compute much quicker which are the different steps to get to the station.
And I've been hearing reports that there was a computer malfunction on board, and Yuri, the mission commander, had to dock it manually. I mean, that's presumably something they'll have trained for a lot to do all that, those emergency situations.
Yes, that's not necessarily an emergency by itself yet, but well, if it comes to docking manually for because you see some deviation that you don't like, this is the prerogative of the commander all the time, and that's really a big part of Yuri Marinchenko's training, 6 times already.
Yeah,
is docking, and he has even docked remotely, so it's in safe hands.
And how much of the time of spending up on the space station, there are going to be 6 people up there for 5 or 6 months, how much spare time are they going to have to enjoy themselves up on the space station, do you think?
Yeah, they will have, we are planning to keep their Sundays free, that's already something.
Yeah.
Although, of course, on Sundays, if they have it free, then they will have to clean.
Right.
Like you at home, if you have it's nobody to clean,
yeah,
for you. And but yes, evenings and so on, they will have an hour or two to enjoy themselves here and there, a little lonely in the timeline, but mostly this on Sunday.
And just finally, do you think you're going to get to go up again?
I don't know. It depends very much on how many opportunities are there for European astronauts. We have probably one more European astronaut, two more that are planned in the next 2 flights, and that will take several years still. So let's see what happens.
Pedro Dugui, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Of course, it's not just people in the space agency and astronauts. We've also got members of the general public here. So let's see what they thought of the event.
I'm joined by Emma Ride from Space Made Simple, based here in Cardiff. And Emma, you go and talk to school kids all the time and show them all sorts of things about space and people going to space. How amazing has this been for you and your project?
This has been the pinnacle of the project, really, because for the past year, we've been doing a project called Tim Peake's Primary Project. So we've been teaching the kids all about what it takes to become an astronaut and what you have to do to get there if you want to be an astronaut for a career. So today has been building up and building up to the Tim Peake launch. So hopefully there's hundreds and hundreds of kids out there that I've been to the various schools doing these workshops that have all been watching the launch and are now enthused, ready for the docking and for Tim Peake being up there.
Go on then, so what do you need to become an astronaut?
Well, to start off with, you need to be very enthusiastic, I would have thought. You also need to be nice and fit and healthy, and you also have to have quite a lot of determination, I would have thought.
I've just stepped out from the hubbub of TechniQuest, where we've got a few hundred people all looking around the exhibits and also watching the screens, and I'm joined by Matt Allen and Scott Balfour, both from postgraduate students from the department here in Cardiff. So you're astronomers, Scott, Matt. Is this exciting for you to have an astronaut up in space?
Yeah, it's really, really exciting. I think it's for us, we're already sort of enthused about science, but I think for everyone else, it sort of gets people really interested in astronomy and astrophysics and science and space travel and NASA and ESA and all those kind of things.
And how about you, Scott?
Well, I mean, it's pretty amazing. I mean, every kid wants to be an astronaut. I think me and Matt probably included in that. But I think we'll never get there, so I think having somebody for the UK go is pretty amazing. And seeing things that we just imagined on screens, they get to see that in reality. It's amazing.
I don't know if it's fair to say you won't get there, because, I mean, Tim Peake has signed up as a job advert, you know, 6 years... Well, 6 years ago he started his training, presumably a job advert a year or two before that. So you've got plenty of time, both of you.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. We could give it a go.
Is it something you'd be interested in?
I don't know. I think I'm a bit too scared to do it myself. But maybe one day.
They wear nappies on the way up, you'd be all right.
Yeah.
And do you think there's anything particularly exciting about this mission in particular? I don't know whether you know much about the stuff that's going on the mission, but anything in particular that you're going to look forward to over the next 5 or 6 months, do you think?
I hope there's some really sort of interesting science that he gets out of it from what he's doing up there, and some of the experiments he's doing, and some of the things in zero gravity, and I know they're trying to test whether life can survive outside the space station, which would be really interesting to see the results of that when he comes back down.
So he's running a marathon on the space station, and they're going to monitor his body. I don't know if you know that, but I think that's pretty cool that he's going to go up there into space and run a marathon in zero gravity. I think that's pretty impressive.
Is he doing it in one sitting? Not sure, but or whether he's doing it in chunks. But it certainly, yeah, it's an interesting thing. How can you run in space, and how does that work? And I know you're both sitting here with two pieces of cardboard in your hands, one piece each. What's that all about, Matt?
So we've been running a project for the last few months where we've been creating these virtual reality apps on your phone, and you can buy these things called Google Cardboard. You put your phone to the front of it, explore the solar system, and you can explore Comet 67P, which Philae landed on. So we've been running that for a few months and just sort of going to public events and trying to show people what a comet actually looks like in 3D in front of them. So it's kind of hard to see, and you always see these great pictures, but it's hard to actually see what it's like in 3D. So that's one thing we're trying to do.
And what's the general feeling here tonight, Scott, do you think? Is there a general buzz around?
I think everybody's very excited, especially the children, and it's nice to see parents so enthusiastic themselves about it. And I think that really to the children.
Cool. Thanks very much.
Yes.
Well, everyone's certainly excited, Edward. What do you think we've got to look forward to in 2016?
Well, we've certainly, with Tim Peake's mission, we've got many discoveries that he's going to do. He's also doing a lot of engagement things. He's done quite a lot of talking to school children already, and that will continue throughout 2016. He has with him a Raspberry Pi, one of these credit card sized computers that are made in Wales, and that was a national competition all over the UK for an experiment involving a Raspberry Pi, and he's taken that up with him. The LISA Pathfinder and New Horizons and all these missions that we've talked about are going to continue producing very exciting results.
It's going to be a fun year again. We've, of course, got Juno arriving at Jupiter in the middle of 2016 as well, so lots to look forward to in terms of fantastic images as well. All that remains is to wish everyone a Happy New Year for 2016.
Happy New Year.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. It was originally broadcast on Radio Cardiff as part of Pythagoras' Trousers.